Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to plunge into the really fascinating stories behind the tech that shapes our world. And today, we're taking a journey through something just fundamental, but maybe we take it for granted, the evolution of networking. I mean, when I think about it, it's just amazing how far we've come. Yeah. I actually remember my family had a 4-digit phone number. This was out in a rural area. And we even shared a party line with the neighbors. Mm-hmm. Seriously. And if you wanted to call someone maybe 20 miles away, you had to get an operator involved. It sounds like ancient history now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially when you hear people talking about mobile service on the moon. It's just wild.
It really is an incredible trajectory. And, you know, our mission today, it isn't just listing the tech milestones, though. Those are definitely cool. We want to go a bit deeper, understand how this whole evolution ties into, well, corporate finance, regulatory politics, which can get pretty messy, and the dynamics of the hardware market, startups included. And the analysts who wrote our source material, they weren't just watching from the sidelines. They were in it, involved in a lot of these key moments. So that gives us a really unique viewpoint, helps us see not just what happened, but crucially, why it matters for, you know, where things are going.
Exactly. And look, you don't need a PhD in computer science for this, we promise. This deep dive, think of it as your shortcut. You'll get genuinely well-informed, pick up some surprising facts, maybe have a few aha moments, all without drowning in jargon. Sound good? All right, let's dig in. Okay, so we kind of have to start at the very beginning. Alexander Graham Bell, 1876, the telephone. Obvious starting point. But the networking part, that really gets going with American Bell Telephone Company in, what, 1881?
That's right, which then became AT&T in 1899. And that original network, you really have to picture it. It's these places called exchanges with human operators, literally plugging wires into patch panels to connect calls. Analog over copper wire. Super hands-on.
Yeah, our source mentions that's where things like 4-digit local numbers came from and why you needed that operator for long distance, even if it was just like the next town over.
And the cost.
Yeah.
The first cost, as they say, of building a network that actually reached enough people to be useful, it was huge. Which explains why basically everywhere phone companies started as regulated monopolies or even government-run things, PTTs they call them. And that setup lasted for a long time, well into the 1980s in most places.
Wow, okay. But obviously that manual analog system couldn't scale forever.
Not at all. So starting in the late 1950s, you see this gradual shift, but it was a really critical one, towards digital. They figured out how to digitize voice. By 1962, devices called channel banks were doing it. They'd sample the analog voice 8,000 times a second, taking an 8-bit snapshot each time. And that created the basic building block. A 64 kilobit per second digital channel.
So like slicing sound into tiny digital pieces, perfectly timed.
Exactly. And in 1965, they introduced the first electronic switching system, the 1ESS, starting to automate that connection process.
Okay, so you have these digital voice channels. How did they connect cities?
They bundled them together using what was called the T carrier system in the US and the E carrier system over in Europe. Think of them as digital highways or trunks.
Right. And what about data? How did that fit in back then?
Well, data was kind of an afterthought initially. You either converted it back to analog using a modem. You probably remember those screeching sounds. Or you could allocate data directly onto those T or E carrier channels. There was a service called Dataphone Digital Service, DDS,
yeah,
in 75. Gave you 56 kilobps.
Pretty fast for the time, I guess.
For the time, yeah. But it was way too expensive for regular people. And you couldn't just run it over your existing phone line, that single twisted pair.
Yeah.
It needed more.
Gotcha.
And the fundamental tech behind all this early digital stuff was pulse code modulation, PCM, that's the digitizing, and time division multiplexing, TDM. TDM is like, imagine a multi-lane road, but each car gets a tiny specific time slot to use a lane. Everything has to be perfectly synchronized across the whole network, like a massive orchestra.
Keeping the rhythm for good voice quality.
Precisely. And even when they upgraded to fiber optics later,
mm-hmm,
around 1988 with Sonnet and SDH, they kept that same synchronized TDM structure. So the legacy was these super reliable digital trunks, predictable service, but also a big problem brewing.
Which was?
There was so much capacity on these digital trunks that voice calls alone weren't even close to filling them up. The network desperately needed data traffic.
Okay, that makes sense. So the pipes were getting bigger, but voice wasn't enough. And you said early data was inefficient, even with things like multi-drop lines from 65, right? Because those dedicated connections just sat idle a lot.
Exactly. That's the key issue with data compared to voice. Data is bursty. You send a chunk, then maybe nothing for a bit, then another chunk. A dedicated line, even a digital one, is mostly empty space between those bursts. Massive waste of capacity.
So how did they solve that? What was the breakthrough?
It came from a Rand Corporation study back in 1966. Really revolutionary thinking. They proposed breaking data messages into smaller pieces called packets. And instead of giving each packet its own dedicated road, you'd send them all mixed together on the same shared trunk line. Statistical multiplexing, they called it.
Ah, so packets could kind of fill in the gaps left by others, making the whole trunk busier and more efficient?
Precisely. If a line's free, your packet goes. If not, it waits a tiny moment. It dramatically increased efficiency and cut costs. This was really the birth of the data network concept.
Wow. And that packet idea wasn't just theory for long, right? ARPANET started using it.
Yep. ARPANET kicked off in 1969, putting that packet theory into practice. And that network, of course, evolved. By 1983, it officially adopted the core protocols we still use today. Internet Protocol, IP, and Transmission Control Protocol, TCP. That's the foundation of the modern internet.
But wasn't there a competing idea around the same time? Something from the international standards folks?
There was. The International Standards Organization, ISO, came up with the OSI model in 1974. Open Systems Interconnection. It was this very structured seven-layer model for how networks should work, and it guided the development of public data networks, especially in Europe. Think standards like X.25 and X.75 from 1976. These were also packet networks, but generally more focused on guaranteed delivery, a bit more like the phone network's mindset.
Okay, so you have the research-driven ARPANET Internet Path with TCP/IP and the more formal standards-driven 06.25 path. What about the big computer companies?
Oh, they had their own ideas, too. IBM, especially, with its Systems Network Architecture, SNA, launched in 1974, very dominant in the corporate world. Other vendors had proprietary systems, too. But by the early 80s, software became really important, and writing software for all these different proprietary networks was a nightmare. Plus, competing with IBM scale was tough. So many non-IBM vendors started moving toward the UNIX operating system.
And Unicus came with
built-in support for TCP/IP. So that really pushed TCP/IP adoption in the business world outside of the IBM mainframe sphere.
Interesting. And weren't local networks becoming a thing then too, inside offices?
Absolutely. The rise of mini computers, then PCs, meant people needed to connect machines within the same building. That led to local area networks, LANs, Xerox PARC's Ethernet is the famous early example, but there were others. Eventually, the IE 802 committee standardized these LAN technologies. And a really clever move was how they designed the network interface card, the NIC. They split the functions. Layer 2, the hardware stuff like Ethernet, was separate from Layer 3, the software driver that handled protocols like IP or SNA.
Ah, so you could swap out the software protocol without ripping out the physical network card.
Exactly. Made things way more flexible.
Okay, so let's recap where we are heading into the 1980s. It sounds like a real mix. You've got enterprises building their own digital networks using those T carrier trunks, running either IBM's SNA or this growing TCP/IP. And then you've got these public packet networks, mostly in Europe, based on the X.25 standard. It feels like things are about to clash, or at least diverge significantly.
You nailed it. The 1980s brought, as our source puts it, two things that happened to change networking completely. Two major forks in the road.
Okay, what were they?
First, a technical fork. The folks working on the internet realized that making every single computer responsible for figuring out routing paths across the whole network was, well, inefficient. It didn't scale. So the idea of dedicated devices just for routing emerged. And boom, Cisco Systems is founded in 1984, building routers. This happened right as all those non-IBM vendors were embracing UNX and TCP/IP. Perfect timing. TCP/IP usage just exploded.
Okay, that's the tech fork. What was the second one?
Regulatory. Pressure built up, especially from consumers and businesses wanting cheaper calls and more options. Governments started privatizing their PTTs and allowing competition to long-distance markets. The famous example is MCI taking on AT&T in the U.S. This wasn't about new tech initially. It was about market structure and pricing. It forced the established players, the telcos, to react.
Right. So the telcos are facing competition and this TCP/IP wave driven by routers and UNIX. How did they try to respond on the technology front?
Well, they didn't stand still. Their big push was something called ISDN Integrated Services Digital Network, standardized in 1988. The idea was to deliver digital voice and data over the existing phone lines to homes and businesses. Basic rate ISDN offered two data channels plus a control channel. Primary rate offered much more capacity.
ISDN, I remember hearing about that, but it never really took off here in the U.S., did it?
Not really. It got some decent traction in Europe, but in the U.S., the rollout was slow, expensive, and kind of confusing. Meanwhile, businesses were already building their own faster networks, using T-carriers and routers with TCP/IP. ISDN just couldn't catch the momentum.
So ISDN was a bit of a stumble. What else did the telcos try?
They also developed Frame Relay around 1984. Our source calls it an UN-protocol, basically a very simple, fast way to ship data packets over their existing digital trunks, stripping out a lot of the old error checking. Think of it as layer one pure transport service.
Faster, but maybe less reliable.
Potentially, yeah. But the big bet, their vision for the future, was ATM, asynchronous transfer mode, standardized in 1989. This was ambitious. It used small, fixed-size 53-byte packets called cells. The idea was these tiny cells could carry anything, voice, video, data, efficiently, over a single network infrastructure. They used virtual circuits, trying to combine the flexibility of packets with the predictability of circuits. It was meant to be the universal convergence technology.
Okay, this is where that philosophical clash really comes into focus, isn't it?
Absolutely. You've got the telco world, steeped in the connection-oriented thinking of the phone network. Reliability is paramount, five nines uptime, 99.999%. Guaranteed quality of service, QoS. Calls either connect or they don't. Fixed paths.
Versus the internet's approach.
Which was fundamentally connectionless. Send the packet out and hope for the best, basically. The network itself didn't maintain any state about the connection. It was designed to be robust. If one path failed, packets could just find another way. Cheaper, more resilient, but best efforts delivery. No guarantees on timing or jitter initially.
These are just fundamentally different ways of building and thinking about a network. It's fascinating how that shaped what they could offer.
Totally. And then right in the middle of this battle between ATM and TCP/IP, something huge happened that shifted the landscape completely.
Let me guess.
The World Wide Web.
Bingo. Tim Berners-Lee creates the web, HTML, HTTP, in 1990. Then, crucially, the internet opens up for commercial use around 1993. And suddenly, internet service providers, ISPs, start popping up everywhere. So, what did this explosion of the web and ISPs mean for the telcos and their big ATM plans?
It basically created this massive, unexpected wave of consumer demand for internet access using TCP/IP. People wanted email, they wanted to browse websites, and the ISPs delivered that directly, often over dial-up initially, then cable modems and DSL, completely bypassing the telco's grand, complex ATM strategy for the core network.
So the market just ran away from ATM.
Pretty much, yeah, at least for general internet access. By the early 2000s, it was clear that ISDN, Frame Relay, and ATM, while maybe technically interesting, were becoming niche or obsolete for mainstream data. IP had won the battle for the desktop and the access network. The whole decade of the 90s, as our source notes, was really about trying to figure out how to make these different network models work together, or which one would ultimately dominate.
Okay, but the telcos did have a point about quality of service, right? The best efforts, internet wasn't always great for things like, say, early video calls or critical business data. How did the IP world address that? Did it just ignore QoS?
No, they couldn't ignore it, especially as businesses started running more important stuff over IP networks. This led to some really key innovations. One approach was called tag switching. The core idea eventually evolved into MPLS, multi-protocol label switching, standardized around 1997.
MPLS, that sounds important. How did it work?
It was pretty clever. Instead of every single router along the path having to look up the full destination IP address and figure out where to send a packet next, which takes time. Packets got a short label or tag attached when they entered the MPLS network. Routers inside the network could then switch the packet based just on that simple label, which is much, much faster. Almost like putting an express lane sticker on your packet.
And this tag could tell the network how to treat the packet, like give it priority.
Exactly. That's the source routing aspect. The entry point decided the path and the QoS treatment based on the tag. So you could create special high-priority path, guarantee bandwidth, and offer end-to-end QoS, but still using the underlying IP infrastructure.
Wow, okay. So MPLS was kind of the bridge technology. It let IT networks offer the kind of guaranteed services the telcos were aiming for with ATM.
It was absolutely pivotal. MPLS effectively provided the missing piece. It allowed network providers to converge everything, the old telco digital services, enterprise private networks, the public internet, onto a single, manageable IP-based infrastructure. Combine MPLS for QoS and traffic engineering with BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol for routing between networks, and you had the recipe for the unified network infrastructure we largely have today.
And things like high-speed broadband cable, DSL, fiber just poured fuel on that fire, right?
Yeah.
Making the internet the default for everything.
Precisely. The internet became the universal dial tone for data. IP was undeniably the platform for the 21st century.
So by the early 2000s, it seems like the all-IP network was inevitable. Our source actually lists five key reasons or truths why IP just took over completely. Let me see if I remember them. First, all business networking basically converged on IP. Even IBM's SNA started running over IP because, well, IP routers were just cheaper and more common.
Right. That consolidation was huge.
Second, the actual underlying connection, like frame relay or ATM, became invisible to computers. They just connected via their LAN or a gateway. So who needed those complex lower layers anymore?
Yep, abstraction hid the complexity.
Third, businesses realized running their own private networks was super expensive, and ISPs could offer reliable Layer 3 IP VPN services much more cheaply using things like MPLS.
Economics driving decisions. Makes sense.
Fourth, just sheer consumer demand for cheap, simple internet access. Anything that complicated that or tried to charge a premium without a clear benefit faced pushback. Think net neutrality arguments.
The market spoke loudly.
And finally, the best efforts. Internet just kept getting better. Broadband speeds improved, latency dropped, making voice over IP, VoIP, totally acceptable, even preferred sometimes. That whole five nines reliability argument from the telco world started to seem less critical for many applications.
Exactly. Good enough became, well, good enough for a massive range of uses, eroding the premium for guaranteed circuits.
So IP conquered the wired world. What about mobile? That seems like the last frontier.
Indeed. Wi-Fi was standardized in 97, offering local wireless IP connectivity. But the real game changer was the smartphone revolution, kicked off arguably by the iPhone in 2007. Suddenly, everyone needed mobile data everywhere. And the mobile standards bodies had anticipated this. They developed something called the IP Multimedia Subsystem, or IMS. Development started way back in 1999 within the 3GPP standards group.
IMS. So this was the mobile world explicitly adopting IP for its core services.
Pretty much. The fact that mobile needed an IP multimedia subsystem was, as our source says, the ultimate proof that IP had won the infrastructure war. IMS is basically the control plane, the brain, that manages setting up and tearing down mobile data sessions, handling voice over LTE, VoLTE messaging, and making sure your data connection follows you as you move between cell towers. It uses things like CSCFs and GTP tunnels to manage it all.
Okay, so IP1, it's the foundation for everything, wired and wireless. But the source throws a curveball here, right? It argues that even things like IMS, designed to support services like mobile voice, are maybe supporting services that don't matter any longer in their original form.
That's the provocative point, yeah. Voice, whether it's old school POTS, VoIP, or VoLTE, is now just another app running over the internet. And its bandwidth needs are tiny compared to, say, streaming 4K video or cloud gaming or massive data uploads.
So if the network isn't primarily about optimizing for voice anymore, what is its true purpose today and going forward? What's the next big driver?
This is where we shift to the future. The argument is the real challenge, the next evolutionary step, is enabling real-time, real-world applications. It's moving beyond just managing information or transactions, what the source calls commercial paper, to actually managing physical work itself.
Managing work, what does that mean in practice?
It means computer systems needing to interact with the physical world almost instantaneously. The prime example is the digital twin concept. Imagine a complex machine, like a jet engine or a factory robot, with a perfect digital replica in the cloud. Sensors on the real machine constantly feed data to the twin. For this to work, the data has to move so fast and reliably that the digital model and the physical reality stay perfectly in sync, harmonious, as the source puts it.
Wow. So the network needs to be fast and reliable enough to keep the digital and physical worlds locked together in real time?
Exactly. Our quality of life, how we work, even safety, think. Autonomous vehicles interacting with smart city infrastructure will depend on this.
And that brings us to things like 6G mobile, which people are already talking about for maybe 2030. They're aiming for goals like 1 microsecond latency. That sounds impossibly fast.
It is incredibly ambitious.
Yeah.
And it bumps right up against physics.
How so?
Well, light in a vacuum travels about 300 meters in a microsecond. In fiber optic cable or copper wire, with all the real-world stuff involved, it's more like 200 meters, maybe a bit less.
So you can only achieve 1 microsecond latency if the computer processing the data is physically within about 200 meters of the thing generating the data.
Pretty much. That latency target is only feasible for very localized processing. You can't send a packet to a data center hundreds of miles away and get it back in a microsecond. Physics says no.
Okay, so 6G's microsecond goal isn't for everything. It's for specific, super local applications.
That's the implication. It highlights why the future probably isn't just one network, but what the source calls a network plus model. Think layers. Yeah. You'll have ultra-low latency compute right at the local edge, then maybe hosted edge compute a bit further away, then regional clouds, then massive central data centers. Each layer offers different latency features and costs.
A tiered system matching the network and compute capabilities to the specific application's needs.
Exactly. It's a cooperative blend of networking and computing.
It's a big shift in thinking. For, what, 80 years or so, networks have mostly been about supporting things we already do, just maybe faster or cheaper.
Right. Evolution, not revolution.
But now, to enable these truly new, real-time, real-world applications, the network itself has to become part of a fundamentally different kind of system. Simple evolution isn't enough anymore.
That's the core argument. The internet we have today, it's brilliant for what we need now. Robust, flexible, connects almost everything. But it's not necessarily the perfect blueprint for that future network, the one that needs to be inextricably linked to our physical lives and work, demanding near-perfect availability and performance for these real-time tasks.
And that kind of network probably isn't going to be free, right? Or just paid for by ads.
Unlikely. Advertising is, what, less than 2% of global GDP? It can't fund this kind of critical infrastructure transformation alone. This future network needs a new economic model, built around services that are genuinely worth paying for because they enable fundamentally new capabilities.
It ties into another point from the analyst. Looking back, every time IT spending grew faster than the overall economy, it was driven by tech that brought computing closer to us.
Yeah, think mainframes to minis, minis to PCs, PCs to mobile devices.
And this next wave, these real-time, real-world applications, is about making the connection between the digital and physical worlds almost seamless. That's the ultimate closeness, in a way.
It really is. Which leads to the final really provocative thought for you, the listener, to chew on. Will the network operators, the vendors, the whole ecosystem, will they proactively embrace this shift? Will they help create the demand for these new applications and build the necessary network plus infrastructure?
Or will they stick to the logic of the past, optimizing the network they already have, and potentially miss out on enabling this very different, maybe much more valuable future?
Yeah. What do you think is the biggest opportunity here, or maybe the biggest hurdle we face in getting to that real-time, real-world future of networking? Something to ponder.
Definitely food for thought. Well, that wraps up our deep dive for today. Thank you so much for joining us on this really fascinating journey through networking's past, present, and potential future. Keep these ideas in mind as you see technology evolving around you. Until next time, keep exploring.